Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the petition to remove Mecklenburg County Sheriff Yuri McFadden is dismissed by the judge at its first hearing. Charlotte City Council votes to provide the Metropolitan Public Transportation Authority with initial funding.
They need our help initially to transact.
As the number of measles cases in South Carolina spreads, the virus is appearing in our wastewater, and despite increasing vaccine hesitancy, the health department is optimistic.
Our team is well prepared to respond.
City leaders hear opposition on the expansion of I-77. Elon University announces the opening of a law school here, and the Hornets are angling to host an NBA All-Star game. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is with us. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, five Mecklenburg County residents, including State Representative Carla Cunningham and former Deputy Sheriff Deputy Kevin Canty, recently filed a petition to remove Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden from office. A Superior Court judge then scheduled a hearing on that petition. That hearing took place yesterday with an interesting outcome. Joe, I believe you were there. What happened?
Yes, I was there. It was dismissed. And when you listen to Sheriff McFadden's attorneys make their arguments in court, it makes sense why it was dismissed. And it comes down to not about any allegation in the filing, but how it was filed. The state law is very clear. A removal petition of this kind can only be filed by the county attorney, the district attorney, or five voters with the approval of the county attorney or district attorney. And so Judge Albright asked the county attorney and district attorney in court, do you approve of this petition? And both said no. So at that point, it was ballgame.
So Eli, why did this happen? Because we had the district attorney on this program early last week, and he talked about the process that this has to go through and the fact that he received the petition and he sent it to the SBI for investigation. And depending upon the outcome of that investigation, he would then decide whether or not to refer this to the judge. Why would you submit a petition and go around the procedure?
Well, I think there's a couple possible reasons. One, this is a really kind of, I think it's fair to say, obscure law. It's not used very often. I had not been familiar with it before. So people don't really necessarily know how it works. If it's supposed to be approved by the district attorney first, I think it's fair to question why the clerk of court received it and filed it, and why the court scheduled a hearing on what the judge said is an invalid petition. But it's also a really clever political move. They filed a petition. They got a ton of news coverage. The primary is in about 8 weeks here, which will determine who's the next sheriff. So by filing this and getting it out in public and not waiting for the district attorney, they've made their point and they've scored a big political hit against the sheriff.
And Joe, I know you want to chime in on this, but that kind of plays into exactly what Sheriff McFadden has been saying about this all along, that it is
right.
Politically motivated and time to coincide with the primaries.
Sure. And I think it would be naive to say it's not. But also, the petition's not gone. It's being investigated by the State right. Bureau of Investigations, and the district attorney or the county attorney can still will still decide whether or not to bring it once they get the results of those investigations. So, you know, the sheriff is still under investigation and this thing's yeah. alive.
Joe?
Yeah. I think this did trigger the SBI investigation. I don't know if there would be an SBI investigation into McFadden without this petition because of the way the claims were presented and the allegations themselves are very serious, that the allegations that are included in that filing. So this is a way to not only get these allegations out to the public before the election, but also to ensure that there is that SBI review. And it is possible after that SBI review, Spencer Merriweather or the county attorney could say, okay, we need to bring this removal petition forward. But you also have to balance that with the fact that Spencer Merriweather has kind of already indicated that he thinks that voters should be the ones who ultimately decide who their sheriff is.
And also, it's a good thing, Republicans, too, obviously, they're making hay out of it politically because the sheriff is supposed to, I believe, testify before or talk before the State Oversight and Accountability Committee about DEI, about public safety, about all these other issues. So they're basically saying, look, you know, look what's going on with the sheriff, the Democratic sheriff.
These allegations include everything from misuse of credit card funds to upgrade hotel rooms and transport visiting officials to strip clubs to a possible alleged violation of the Hatch Act, which prohibits the use of equipment, personnel, or facilities for political purposes. I don't know if any of that's true, and the sheriff says none of it is true. But this little-known law that allows five people to petition for the removal of an elected official. No one really knew about this. And I think one of the McFadden attorneys has said, if this becomes the way we do things, it'll be chaos. Well, isn't the cow out of the barn now? I mean,
yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that it's for sheriffs and law enforcement officers only. Okay. So you can't take this and say, hey, we got five people. We want to get rid of the mayor or this state representative or a senator. It only applies to this specific category of sheriffs or law enforcement officials. But I mean, it's very easy for me to imagine this becoming a much more common thing because we've seen how politicized law enforcement has become in the past 5 years, especially. You know, you could have voters petitioning to remove a sheriff because they think they're too lenient on immigration or because they think they're doing too much cooperating with ICE. I mean, you could really see this gaining more momentum. It's a pretty unusual law to me.
As long as we're talking about law enforcement, CMPD released crime statistics for last year. I think it was yesterday, and they shared some good news in the process. Eli, what did they report?
So they reported that despite the number of high-profile crimes, some of which drew national attention, overall crime was down in the city. Homicides, there were 96 in 2025 compared to 110 in 2024. So that's a fairly significant drop, I think around 13%. There were fewer reported aggravated assaults, rapes, robberies, and property crimes, although property crimes like residential burglaries did not, and larcenies from cars, those did not fall nearly as much as the violent crime reports. So overall, they were pretty positive about the numbers they saw in 2025. But I think that there's still, given the attention on high-profile crimes like the killing of Irina Zarutska on the light rail and violent crime uptown, still a big perception problem for the city to address this year.
Eric.
Yeah, Eli hit on a couple of things that I saw the chief speak to a group of tourism executives Wednesday, which is the day before the report was released. And she hit on some of those themes, saying that the statistics would come out and show the numbers that Eli just mentioned, but that there is a lot of work to do. She spoke specifically about uptown and the need to continue to improve there, which they've formed some task forces and special groups that have made some arrests and seized some guns in the last couple of months. And the other thing that she mentioned pretty pointedly is that CMPD has about 1,800 officers. They are short. And she said that as proud as she is of her officers, that it does affect morale and they've got to find a way to fill in the gaps in terms of having enough officers. So I thought that was interesting.
I wonder about how many officers we have, because we keep hearing that in Minneapolis, they only have 600 police officers for that city and 600 for St. Paul. We have 1,800 police officers here. That's interesting. This report also shows, and you kind of alluded to this, Eric, that officer-initiated proactive activity rose 21%. What exactly, Eli, does that mean?
So that is police approaching someone and talking to them. It doesn't necessarily mean police doing arresting someone or, you know, stopping a crime, but it means instead of sitting in a car or in a station and waiting for a call to come in and going out and responding. That is police going out on their own initiative, seeing something and starting to talk to someone, investigate something. One criticism, you know, that I think you've heard, not just in Charlotte, but around the country, is that police have initiated a lot fewer actions since the lens really started to focus more on police actions after things like George Floyd, which was started by a report, but, you know, obviously resulted in a ton of questions about how police responded. We've seen in Charlotte fewer police-initiated interactions, fewer traffic stops, and really a reversal of police being proactive. And I think Stella Patterson is going to try to continue to change that and say, hey, we're getting out of the cars, we're walking the beat, we're going to talk to people, we're going to be visible, not just sitting back and waiting for reports to come in. So we're going to see more proactive policing under her, I believe.
For those people who may have... Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, yeah, but politically, it's interesting because the Trump administration has been sending troops and Border Patrol and other places into cities, basically saying, because crime is out of control. So I think a lot of police departments around the country have said, listen, we're going to make sure that our crime rates are going down, that we're doing everything we can do. I know, like in Baltimore, they're actually investigating who might be either the perpetrator or the victim of a crime and getting involved in helping those folks, because they really do not want to have that as an excuse, because we see what can happen.
For those people who may have lost the thread on this, we have a new police chief. She took office, I think, beginning of December?
Yeah.
Stella Patterson, or Stella Patterson, as she likes to call herself. And she says her department's officers work every day to defuse conflicts, to address crimes as they unfold, prevent escalations of violence, all in order to keep neighborhoods safe.
We're going to make every effort to keep having them go down, to be in those places particularly that we know are problematic, that tend to see increases in crime. And I also know in our world today, we can't always predict that, right? Because it can happen anywhere. But we want to make sure that we have eyes and ears in all the places that we can to mitigate it as much as possible.
And she said that these declining crime numbers are more than just numbers. They are, quote, the outcome of targeted strategies. Eli?
And I think it's important to note that her number one priority that she listed yesterday when she was going through this report was reducing violent crime and disorder. And that really gets to the perception, I think, where you have, you know, even if you can point to a statistic and say, well, the number of assaults is down X percent, when there's visible disorder, like we've seen a big focus on reducing street takeovers and people taking over intersections and doing burnouts in high-powered cars, that visible disorder matters a lot to people. I think Chief Patterson's going to focus a lot on that. The other thing that I always want to highlight in this discussion is, yes, 96 homicides is down from last year. That's good. It is still about almost double the homicides we were seeing many years last decade. So we are seeing fewer homicides year over year, but many more homicides decade over decade.
Many years, I mean, decade over decade, this was a much smaller city 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
Not that much smaller. I mean, there was, I think in 2015, which is 10 years ago, I think we had 54 homicides. So, you know, we weren't twice as small 10 years ago. We were a little smaller.
Hey, when you look at the thing on a graph, when you look at the homicide rate year by year on a graph, it's kind of like a roller coaster. It's up, it's down, it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about how City Council voted this week to fund the Transportation Authority, the new organization that will run CATS and other things. Retail's coming to Eastland Yards, and measles cases are on the rise. We'll talk about that as well. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup. Eli Portillo is with us. He's senior editor at WFAE News. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is with us. He is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Well, the sales tax referendum to fund our transit plan passed, and as a result, a new entity was created, the Metropolitan Public Transportation Authority. Eric, remind us what they're supposed to do.
So they're supposed to do two things, Mike. They will oversee about $17.5 billion worth of transit construction projects, rail and improvements to bus service. That includes some federal money. And they will also take control and ownership of Charlotte area transit system from city government. So they have to do those two things.
So evidently, this body came into being with an unfunded mandate. And this week, Charlotte City Council put some money into their coffers, $4.3 million. Republican Council Member Ed Driggs was a proponent of doing that.
And I think it's pretty clear. We've got to get some money into this organization. At their first meeting, they kind of sat there. They didn't have a dime, right? They didn't have a bank account. They need our help initially to transact and to gradually inflate this thing and build it up.
So, Joe, is Charlotte the only municipality that's going to be kicking money into this entity?
For now. We'll see. I don't know. Other municipalities have money to give. CATS is under Charlotte's control. It makes sense for Charlotte
to be clear, CATS is under Charlotte's control now, but they
for now, be. Yeah, it makes sense for Charlotte to be the sugar daddy in this situation, if you will, to provide the funding for MPTA. They do need money. They need to get off the ground. They need insurance. They need to have some freedom to do some things. And, you know, it's going to be a slow process, but eventually we're going to start thinking of transit as an MPTA function. I also think it's interesting that the FTA administrator is in town today. It's a private meeting, too, which I really think is interesting. He's going to be riding the light rail. With CATS. This isn't a show where, you know, I don't know. We're so ingrained now where we think everything is political and people are coming down to rah-rah-rah and talk about Charlotte Transit. But this is a private meeting. That says to me that the FTA and CATS, MPTA, whatever you want to call it, they're having serious conversations about Charlotte's transit future.
So as a result of this yes vote on transit, Mecklenburg County sales tax will go up from 7.25% to 8.25% in July, and it's forecast to generate $19.4 billion over 30 years. So will some of that money raised from that tax stream be used to further fund the Metropolitan Transit Authority
forward? This is purely a stopgap measure. And remember, it's only $4 million, which is not that much. And remember that the $4 million is coming from existing transit tax money that goes to CATS anyway. So in essence, it is the MPTA's money, or will be as of July. So this is not that big of a stretch, but it is kind of funny. You know, you heard that clip from Councilman Driggs. Members of the MPTA at the second meeting, there were questions about legal maneuvers. And at one point, the chair, David Howard, said, look, we don't have a bank account. We don't have money. We can't get a lawyer right now. And so it was just kind of like, what do we do?
So since the transit plan is the city's baby and they fought hard to get permission for this referendum, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that the vote on this was unanimous, was it?
Indeed it was.
Okay. We have an update on Eastland Yards, the old Eastland Mall site. City Council voted on Monday to approve lease agreements with the first four retail tenants. Joe, who are those tenants?
We have Rumbau Latin Dance Company, Suites by Alvo Runga, and we have Artisan Gelato and Higher Grounds Coffee Shop. Those last two businesses are owned by Manolo Betancourt.
I'll be there at the gelato and the coffee shop.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's the first local coffee shop in District 5, which is really cool to hear about.
So the city has entered into this master lease with the developer, Crossland Southeast, the developer, I just said that, and is subleasing the retail space at discounted rates. Why?
Their goal is to give small businesses a shot at getting a brick and mortar location. They want to be intentional about the development. They don't want it filled up with chains. They want it with businesses that people who live in District 5 will actually benefit from. So like the master lease with the developer, I believe is $39.70 per square foot. and Higher Grounds, for example, is paying $22 per square foot, which is about an $18,000 a year difference. And we heard about Rumbel Latin Dance Company. You know, they got tight margins. It's a dance studio. They apparently have looked for brick and mortar location for many years now, but they just have not been able to find somewhere that gives them flexibility with, you know, and financially, just, you know, it's hard to run a dance studio at a profit. So a place like Eastland Yards that's offering that 5 years of a low rent rate really plays a huge role for them to imagine their dream of a brick and mortar location.
So, Eric, I know you want to chime in, but I also have a question about this. Will these rent reductions be in perpetuity, or is it based somehow on revenues that they ultimately bring in once they get established, Eric?
My guess is they will be in perpetuity. Now, each of them has a clause for revenue sharing if they hit certain sales figures, and the rent does go up as is standard in these contracts, I think. It may be 3% a year or something. So it does not stay the same, but it does not go up to market rate, at least at any point in the initial term. I was going to mention two things, Mike. One is, so those four businesses that Joe just delineated are going to occupy about half the space in the bottom of these two buildings, these two apartment buildings that are opening in the next 2 months. So there's still a lot of room for other businesses. And the second point I was going to make is that one of the executives from Crosland who was at the meeting specifically said that what they don't want is not only the chains, they don't want vape shops and that kind of thing. They want to make sure that they have sustainable businesses that benefit the community, but also that help create economic prosperity. Remember, East Charlotte is one of the least affluent areas of the city. That's a big reason why the city got involved in this from the start.
Which leads me to this. Joe, you spoke with newly minted city council member J.D. Mazura Arias, who pointed to this development as giving the city the momentum it needs for Eastland Yards.
We had an economic incubator monster, which was Eastland Mall from 1975 to 2010. And then after that, it was largely deserted. And it really extracted all of the economic activity and vibrancy that East Charlotte has felt. And so bringing in these four small businesses to sublease property on Eastland Yards is a huge accomplishment.
So what, they have a lot of space out at Eastland Yard. At what stage is this development in today, Joe?
Yeah, I was out there for this story. A lot of the housing is, the housing is the first part of it. So we got these two apartment complexes that are going up. It's market rate rent for these two apartment complexes with the retail. I was looking, I think it's $1,500 for a one bedroom mm-hmm. a month. And then we have an affordable housing complex over on the far east side, far west side. That is dedicated to seniors. There's also going to be some market rate homes and townhomes for sale. But the big part that's going to bring people to Eastland Yards. We got the park that's under construction that's going to be directly in front of these two apartment complexes. And then later this spring, we're going to have a groundbreaking for the amateur sports facility, which is going to have basketball, soccer, ability to convert into other sports. And I don't think Charlotte realizes just yet about how much money there is in amateur sports. Mm-hmm. Rock Hill has a similar facility. It brings in about $77 million a year in economic impact. Travel sports nowadays are expensive, and they are all the time. There are going to be so many people coming to Eastland Yards to participate in basketball tournaments, competitive cheer tournaments. Manolo's coffee shop and ice cream shop are going to be very busy when those open.
And he's got his documentary. They want to go to the Change Baker, right?
I have to put this on my calendar and budget for it. So tell me when these places open.
I believe 2027 will be probably when the ice cream and the coffee shop.
Can you hold out that long, Mike?
I don't think so. No. The vote to approve these leases was not unanimous. Councilwoman Luana Mayfield voted against it. Why?
She was go ahead, Joe.
She had an issue with the suites by Alva Runga. Forgive me if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. It's a salon suite type business, which is when there's multiple suites, possibly different salons that are in that one storefront. The business owner herself is from Greensboro. I think she wanted to be a little more intentional about Charlotte businesses and people who've come through the city's programs. But she also has met with the salon owner. So has council member Mazura Arias. They both said that she's great. So, it was just a procedural thing. She wants Charlotte businesses to benefit from this.
So an illness that we thought in this country was virtually eradicated is making a comeback. Measles. This fall, there was an outbreak in Spartanburg, South Carolina, that for the moment appeared to be contained, but evidently is continuing to spread. Mecklenburg County Health Director Dr. Raynard Washington.
The situation in South Carolina does not seem to be getting better. And so the longer it carries on, the more likely there'll be a case in Mecklenburg County. Our team is well prepared to respond to it. We have measles tabletop exercises.
I don't know what they are. Perhaps it's the home game. But there is a reason for this, I guess. The measles virus is showing up in Mecklenburg County's wastewater. Eli, what does that mean?
So basically, that means that someone who is either living here or passing through here, doing their business here, is infected with measles. Dr. Washington said that it could be someone who has come for medical treatment or someone who lives here. But what they, it's one of the diseases they sample for regularly. Basically, this is a little gross, but every day they're dipping a ladle in and seeing what diseases are in the wastewater, and they've detected measles here. Now, in South Carolina, they are up over 430 cases, most of them in the upstate. That continues to increase by, you know, more than 100 cases this week. They also have detected more cases in western North Carolina. I think the latest is two new cases in Buncombe County. So, you know, Dr. Washington said, the longer this goes on, as you heard, he said it's pretty much inevitable. Someone either is or will be infected here in Mecklenburg County.
Mary.
And yeah, the thing of it is measles is highly contagious. It's one of those ones, if somebody's in the room and, you know, after they leave, somebody can come in and get it. It's also a disease that has an incredibly effective vaccine. So a lot of this comes from vaccine skepticism. It comes from the very top. We know RFK Jr. has, you know, there are a lot of vaccine skeptics at the CDC, and people have been able to ask for exemptions, and more people are asking for vaccine exemptions. But the thing is, you need herd immunity for it to be effective. And there are people out there who are too young, babies are too young to get the vaccine, or they're immunocompromised. And so, you know, this is going to be a problem. And as you said in the beginning, it's a shame because this is a disease we thought had been eradicated. And the numbers of vaccinations are going down. People are getting more exemptions. And in some areas, the Spartanburg area, I was hearing some counties, they're really low. And people travel. We live in a mobile society, so it's never going to be just limited to one area or another.
Eli.
And it's not just measles. I was actually more struck during Raynard Washington's presentation by the pertussis or whooping cough numbers. 2 years ago, there were four cases of that reported here. Last year in 2025, there were 67 cases here. So that is a really huge increase, about a factor of 15. Yeah. And, you know, that, of course, can be prevented with the DTaP vaccine that you get regularly. But a lot of people, more people are skeptical.
Yes. YouTube, Instagram, TikTok are not experts in science. They are not your physician. And vaccine hesitancy is increasing. And that's one of the things that Raynard Washington pointed to.
We are seeing a growing number of families who are requesting exemptions from being able to adhere to CMS's requirements for vaccines.
The effectiveness of this vaccine is 93% immunity after the first shot, 97% after the second shot. Have there been any significant health problems among people who have gotten the vaccines? Do we know?
Well, I'm not a doctor, so, you know, I'm going to stick with what the CDC and my doctors and my kids' doctors say.
You mean the old CDC.
Yes, which is that this vaccine is safe and effective and, you know, recommended for all kids. The thing is, like Mary mentioned, herd immunity means almost everybody. We need 95% coverage to prevent outbreaks, and among K through five students in CMS, Dr. Washington said that has fallen to about 92% of students and is trending down. So it's still a large majority, but it's below where we need to be. It's already below where we need to be to prevent outbreaks, and it's trending lower.
And we should say that kids who get the shot, if you get the shot, you're not going to get sick. Kids don't have to get sick, and they don't have to die from this. Mm-hmm. But if you don't get the shot, you might. Well, we also received word yesterday that Dr. Raynard Washington will resign his position as Mecklenburg County's health director, effective on Tuesday of next week. He's been with the county since 2020. He's been nominated to serve as the state of New Jersey's health commissioner. What, New Jersey? Actually, New Jersey's a great state. My brother lives there. It's very pretty.
My family's from New Jersey. I wouldn't recommend it, though.
Dr. Kimberly, the taxes are ridiculous. But Dr. Kimberly Scott will serve as the interim health director here once Dr. Raynard Washington leaves.
Well, good luck, because so many doctors are saying they're so frustrated because they can give the advice, but there are people coming in and said, well, I read this on the internet. They do their own Dr. Google, so it's very difficult.
Okay, so the proposed expansion of I-77 with toll lanes from uptown to South Carolina has become controversial, and business leaders are noticing this. What has given rise, Eric, to the controversy?
Well, I think people are starting to pay closer attention, quite honestly, and recognizing that this is, relatively speaking, a narrow corridor. And when it was originally built, it disrupted a number of historically Black neighborhoods, and it will do so again if it is expanded. Remember, we're talking about two lanes on each side for 11 miles from the South Carolina state line to uptown. And now, as we're getting into a period of the NCDOT holding forums and participating in neighborhood conversations, a lot of people are beginning to rally and say, we don't want this in this form.
Did they not anticipate this? So you can't go too far into the, you can't encroach too far into the uptown side of things. The only way to go is to the west. So did they not anticipate this?
Well, I think that a lot of this is probably a conversation of what do we do to relieve what is already a terrible situation. And proponents are looking at things of not only commutes, but also moving products back and forth. And so I think that a lot of this resulted from, we have to do something. This is the best way to do it. I should say now, the design is not finalized. This is still under consideration, discussion. People have mentioned going underground, which obviously is much more expensive. It seems much more likely that they will elevate, which would encroach.
Okay. So very quickly, at 20 seconds, less than 20 seconds, Eli.
There's been a ton of attention on the bad effects of highway construction on Black communities in the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are surprised that this plan would repeat that.
I vote for going elevated. We'll just do it. I win. We're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their small classes offer a supportive learning environment where middle schoolers can develop curiosity and essential skills like critical thinking, collaboration, and problem solving. Details at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. Eli Portillo is senior editor for WFAE News. He's here along with Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, Channel 9. A couple of years ago, Eli, Charlotte joined other cities in embarking on a Vision Zero plan to reduce traffic fatalities to zero by the year 2030. I've done the math 4 years from now, and now a new report for 2025 shows mixed progress. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's not looking great in terms of reaching that goal. It was always, I think, very ambitious to say we'll completely eliminate serious injuries and traffic fatalities. But last year in 2025, we saw 81 people who died in traffic wrecks on Charlotte's streets. And that's an increase from the prior year. So we are trending the wrong way. I believe serious injury crashes were also up 13%. And, if you look at it overall, 81 people dying on the roads is close to the number of people dying in homicides. So advocates are concerned that Charlotte does not seem to have a comprehensive plan to reach Vision Zero. And, I think that they're behind the scenes is you're hearing more skepticism about, was this kind of just a, was this a slogan all along, yeah, or is this a real goal?
So we have fewer crashes reported, but we have more fatalities resulting from those crashes. And Shannon Binns is the founder and executive director of Sustain Charlotte. He explained to WFAE's Marshall Terry on Morning Edition what he sees as the fundamental problem.
Well, the core, children, parents, and seniors in our community are dying simply because our streets are designed for speed, not protecting human life.
And he went on to say that our Vision Zero policy puts human life first, but the reality is the opposite on our streets, and the state shoulders some of the blame.
You know, more of our problems are actually on roads that are maintained by the North Carolina DOT. And the problem is they have not been willing to modify them to make them safer. So we essentially have what have been designed as highways to move cars as quickly as possible through residential areas, through neighborhoods. And that's the problem.
81 pedestrians, as you mentioned, Eli, died, I believe.
Pedestrians and motorists.
And died in 2025. And a pedestrian was killed in a hit and run just, I think, 2 days ago. At 36th Street and the Plaza on Wednesday night, a young guy, 25 years old, and some of us know him. So the goal was zero fatalities by 2030, just 4 years away. And Shannon Binn says that part of the problem is that on the streets where we tend to have fatalities, those streets often remain unchanged. Are policies going to change? Is the goal unrealistic?
Well, I think in a city where almost everyone commutes by car almost every day, zero is unrealistic in any sort of short term or medium term. It's a great goal. Like, zero homicides would also be a great goal. It's probably unrealistic in a society where we have, you know, a gun for every person. The policies that Shannon Binns and other safety advocates are hoping for are doable on smaller budgets. There are things like, you know, putting up bollards to protect pedestrians, narrowing lanes. But a lot of it comes down to politics. As you and Shannon said, the state controls big thoroughfares like Providence, like 51, like Brookshire, et cetera, where these fatal high-speed crashes tend to be more concentrated. And you know, the NCDOT doesn't want to, and I think, frankly, a lot of people who live there would also object to putting, you know, large-scale traffic mitigation measures on, say, Providence Road. That would be really tough politically, and, you know, it's a big fight.
Moving on, the Trump administration has changed the rules governing work requirements for those on Medicaid, and now the state is facing a looming deadline to find more funding for that program. The state says these changes will cost the state around $50 million. Eli, why?
So these work requirements that people who are able-bodied adults have to be either working or in job training or volunteering for 20 hours a week, it's a lot to track. The administrative burden is very high. You're talking about, you know, a system to track the work or volunteer amounts of, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands or millions of people. The state isn't getting any money to do that from the federal government. The federal government is just saying, hey, you know, stand up this big administrative infrastructure. And, you know, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services estimates that'll cost around $50 million.
Yeah, and it can't come from tax dollars, evidently. And if we can't find a source for that funding, Medicaid expansion will automatically be repealed. Several funding options were presented to the General Assembly this week, however. What were they?
I think the big picture, besides any of the actual options, is that there's a March deadline. Mm-hmm. And the state is not anticipating getting a budget before April at the very earliest. So actual dollar and cents numbers aside, the real big story here is simple date math. And if they can't get it by the end of March, we're going to be looking at some really big problems.
And even if they come back into session, which is unlikely, there's still some opposition among Republicans about all of this. Speaking of the General Assembly, they have yet to pass the budget for the fiscal year. We're the only state in the country without a budget, and teacher salaries and those of state employees are in limbo as a result. During a visit to East Mecklenburg High School on Tuesday, Governor Josh Stein pled with legislators to get on with it.
We've got to get this done. I urge the legislature to come back this week, to come back next week, to come back in February, to come back in March. We've got to pass a budget, and I'm at the table, ready to work with anyone to advance the interests of the state.
Is anyone on Jones Street listening?
No. They don't seem to be.
And, you know, Governor Stein says he's willing to work with them. He's on the sidelines. You know, this is really just the legislative leaders. This is an intra-party fight between, you know, Berger and Hall in the Senate and the House. And their issues are on around things like tax rates and how quickly those should fall, whether the state should fund another children's hospital in eastern North Carolina. And it's really those are what's holding up the budget at this point.
And to get so back to food assistance for programs for kids, the governor was also saying that, you know, they want the General Assembly to put $5 million in funds to ensure that North Carolina can feed kids during the summer when they're not getting their meals at school. So, you know, again, he's going with hat in hand for this program to help fund it and help more than a million kids.
The U.S. economy, and in fact the economy of the world, depends on the United States Federal Reserve being unencumbered by political interference. But Donald Trump wants to run the Fed, and he has childishly called Fed Chair Jerome Powell any number of names. Now, Trump's Justice Department is going after Jerome Powell and is conducting a criminal investigation to see if he made false statements to Congress about the cost and scope of the Fed's multi-billion-dollar headquarters renovation project. Trump and Powell had a little run-in, I thought that was settled in public on camera, about that funding this past summer, where Trump said something and Powell corrected him. Is this an offshoot of that, Mary?
Yes. I mean, basically, Trump is very open about what he wants, which is to have control of the Fed. That's also why he's wanting to get rid of Lisa Cook on the Fed. And he has been pressuring Jerome Powell to lower interest rates. He thinks it will be good for him politically. And you see, even someone like Tom Tillis, who now that he's not running again, has found his voice, who's a Republican senator, saying that he will oppose any nominee for the Fed until the legal questions around Jerome Powell and the Justice Department are hammered out, because you see other Republican senators doing this as well. This is the independence and credibility of the Department of Justice, of the Fed, of our money supply, and this could have far-reaching effects in America. And Tillis is a member of the Banking Committee.
He released a statement saying that, quote, if there was any remaining doubt whether advisors within the Trump administration are actively pushing to end the independence of the Federal Reserve, there should be none now. How much power does a Senator Eric have in these situations?
Well, the Senate will have approval.
Can
power.
He stop a nomination?
He's going to need some help.
Yeah. Other Republicans are going to have to join
him. It depends
what
the other Republicans do. But I was going to say, Mike, to Mary's point about the independence of the Fed, remember we just had this with the government, even before the government shut down, when the jobs numbers weren't going the way that the president wanted them to go. In essence, they just ended up stopping conducting the surveys. I mean, these are economic barometers that are trusted, that are established. We are talking about our entire monetary system here when you start meddling in these types of issues and with these types of executives.
So yesterday, the Democrat running to replace Tom Tillis in the United States Senate, former Governor Roy Cooper, was asked at an event here in Charlotte about his opinion of the Trump administration's actions in Venezuela against Nicolas Maduro.
So this is about oil profits. This is a bad guy that they should get, but to run Venezuela in order to get oil profits, that's wrong, and I don't think the people of this country want that.
He also criticized likely Republican opponent Michael Whatley, in November at least, he'll be the opponent, as likely, as someone who supported the plan because of his past work as an oil and gas lobbyist. Just a little sidebar here. The mother of a 13-year-old boy is calling on CMS to release the surveillance video that she says shows an administrator at Renaissance West Steam Academy assaulting her son in October. Why is this just coming to light now, Eli?
Well, I think WCNC and Nate Morbido over there have been trying to report this for a while. Basically, the family has been attempting to get CMS to release a video of the incident. And they claim that a security video shows this interaction, that it shows the administrator basically being out of control and slamming the student and by his head into the ground, a 13-year-old boy. CMS has not released it. They've gone public with this now after trying to get CMS to release it and reach a settlement with them to put more pressure on the school system to release this video, which they say should be a public record and which their lawyer says proves their point.
So the mother says her son suffered a traumatic brain injury and other injuries. A school resource officer determined that both parties, the child and the administrator, were at fault, but the family says the video contradicts that. We know from experience now that videos may or may not contradict things, and they're open to interpretation. So we'll see what happens there. What happens next with that, by the way?
The family says that if CMS doesn't release the video, they have a draft lawsuit that they've shared with us, and they say they'll pull the trigger on it and file it.
So on January 1st, Governor Stein signed a new law that banned cell phones from being used during instruction in classrooms. We mentioned that Governor Stein was at East Mecklenburg High School this week, where several teachers thanked him for signing that bill. They say the result will be an end to the struggle of gaining students' attention because they won't be distracted by devices. This is happening in a lot of places around the country. And was this passed by the General Assembly by a wide margin, Joe, or was it a close vote?
Yeah, this was a pretty significant bipartisan support for this bill. I think that, you know, it's hard to imagine almost like, so when I was in high school, we had cell phones, but my cell phone didn't have internet on it. So it's kind of weird to even think about using phones in class or the ability to do so. But a lot of schools were caught flat-footed, and now there is this policy where, you know, every teacher has to follow the same rules, not having phones in class during instruction time, whereas it used to be kind of each teacher had their own policy.
Which worries some parents because they want to be able to reach their children, but the governor was here and he tried to allay those fears.
What the teacher said their solution has been is to not take this phone from the student at the beginning of the day and the student can't touch it for 8 hours, but rather to have it at the front of the classroom so that if, God forbid, some terrible incident did happen on this campus, the student could get the phone and reassure their parents that they're okay.
So I don't have time to go into this now, but Joe, you report that the first ballots in the 2026 midterm elections have already been cast. They were cast by somebody living in Banner Elk, well, somebody from Banner Elk living in Toronto, and three residents from Kerry living in Luxembourg and Tucson, Arizona. So the race is underway. Meanwhile, a former IT employee is suing the town of Mooresville. We must talk about this because it involves a pantsless mayor. What is going on here, Eli? Quickly.
Jeffrey Noble, he's the former IT worker. He's sued the town. He says he was fired after he disclosed the existence of a video showing Mayor Chris Carney walking through town hall late at night without pants on. We know from this incident that the police were summoned to town hall. The mayor was there. He was there with a female consultant. He has said that he was trying to sober up after having a few drinks.
He was caught on security cameras walking around way after hours, early morning hours,
like,
without
like
pants.
3 a.m.
Is that illegal?
You know, I mean, it's really a let's not cast the first stone situation.
It's unseemly. Let's just put it at that.
Okay. Here's something we don't see every day in Charlotte. On Wednesday, a group of Vietnamese monks crossed the state line from South Carolina into Charlotte as part of a 2,300-mile pilgrimage from Fort Worth, Texas to Washington on foot. They're known for walking barefoot, but I did notice it's cold. They were wearing tennis shoes, many of them. How many monks were making this pilgrimage, Mary? Quickly.
I'm not sure how many. Okay. What? How many?
About 24.
About 24. Okay. But I think people want some peace.
Yes. And
world.
That's exactly what they said their mission is.
Just one word, peace. And we don't want it just to end whenever this journey finished in Washington, D.C., because it took so much effort and energies and sacrifice.
Just so you know, hundreds of people joined in this march as they crossed the state line. Hundreds of people. And evidently, they have a dog on their walk. He's a rescue dog who lost his leg in an accident on this walk. It was amputated, but the dog is back. Just want to let you know that good things happen to those who chant. Eli Portillo, Joe Bruno, Mary C. Curtis, Eric Spanberg. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.